philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Negative. I am a meat popsicle.
Mindless philosopher, you overweight glob of grease.
I'm gonna have to science the shit out of this.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 24. It feels like a good number. Now you've got one episode for every hour in your day. So every day, if you stay up for a full 24 hours, you can listen to the whole back catalog all the way through. That sounds like a good use of time. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. I want to, if it's all right, I'd like to open with a disclaimer here.
Hold on. A little wooden ball just rolled down a series of Rube Goldberg weirdly designed devices. And it says here that, it's the victim is our audience. I don't know what that means. You can interpret however you want, but that's what it says.
That seems fair. I want to say something very specifically to our audience, specifically our SIO listeners, those who might have heard the most recent episode that I was on. I just want to get it really clear from the start. I do not believe that precognition is possible. I'm not saying it's possible. I just think if you look at the data, right, if you look at the crime rate, the drop in crime rate that is statistically significant, I think it'd be worth a little bit more research. That's all. I don't want to get a bunch of hate mail. I just want to say, you should look at this a little bit more. That's all.
We are, of course, talking about Minority Report this week. There is the murder rate going to 0% in D.C. in 20 whatever year it's supposed to be is evidence, is all we're saying. That is evidence of a kind. You know, it's
I understand that 100% is different from 31% to 26%. Do not at me. We'll have a conversation about how even at 100%, you still would act the same way. But we're going to get there. We're going to get there is what I'm saying. But you probably want to do Exposition Zone first, right?
Yeah, enough stirring stuff to lose listeners. Let's Exposition Zone for Minority Report.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement. Between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the Exposition Zone.
All right. I love this movie. I'm going to come out and say it. This is a great movie. It really is. And I saw it in theaters at the time in 2002. And then I even watched it again later on. We rented it and I watched it at home or something. Like, it was one of those kind of movies. I only have like three of those in my life. Because my dad hated watching everything, pretty much. He would only watch. He was very selective, and he would never watch the same movie twice. But this one, Meet the Parents around the same time. That was actually a really good movie, too, that first one. We'll do an episode on that later.
You know, I think this is the second best of the Philip K. Dick movie adaptations, depending on what you think about Blade Runner. Number one being Scanner Darkly.
They say this is better than Blade Runner.
I agree.
Scanner Darkly is the number one.
Yeah, I believe that Scanner Darkly is by far the best Philip K. Dick movie ever made. And then this, and then Blade Runner, I suppose.
I haven't seen Scanner Darkly, so there we go. I'm sure we just lost some more listeners.
On the list for everyone who's still here.
Okay, good. Well, we'll get to it. I'll be excited. And we'll do a three-part episode, and it won't make any sense to me, I'm guessing. But no, this movie is really cool. I like it a lot. And like even watching it going back, you know, now it's what, 16 years old, it kind of holds up. Like there's parts of it that I think are there's chase scenes where it was like the effing prequel Star Wars movies level, you know, like droids falling in and out of
literally
barrels
both of them
and
yet
stuff.
A factory.
that was pretty bad. Like there's a couple chase scenes. I was just like, all right, this is stupid. But short of that, like, take those away. It's actually pretty good, and it holds up. And, like, it looks pretty good still. You know, I didn't feel like it looked super fake or anything. Did you? It
no.
looks pretty good.
I think it's beautifully designed. It's peak Spielberg. You know, I think it's a wonderfully done movie with a couple of very ridiculous problems, but mostly great, mostly great.
But anyway, so for those who aren't familiar with the story or the movie, we'll do our exposition here. Tom Cruise, he plays a man who is able to run well. That's his main character trait in every
also
Tom
peak Tom Cruise
movie.
In this movie.
He's able to run really well. Like, he's so good at pumping his friggin' arms, just like a beast, just like,
yep.
And he's 5'3", so he's like, he's not getting anywhere, you know?
he's not, treadmill.
Yeah, he's easily, like, could be outrun by even an out-of-shape dude who's a little taller, I feel like. But, like, he can look like he's running so hard. That's why Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise.
My favorite Tom Cruise scene in this movie is Tom Cruise's favorite memory is Tom Cruise teaching his junior Tom Cruise how to run properly. That is the peak Tom Cruise moment of all time.
So good. I just realized we need to watch The Edge of Tomorrow because that's also Tom Cruise. Yeah, and it also involves weird time travel. And I also really like that movie. But anyway, back to this movie. And also, have I confessed my perhaps unpopular opinion on this show that I think Tom Cruise is actually a pretty good actor? Have I?
No, but I think that's acceptable. I think he's above average.
He's good. He's, you know, like I never watch a movie and think he's the problem with the movie. You know, it's more like too much running, but, or maybe that is him. I don't know. Maybe that's in his contract. Like every movie is like, I only see 3 running scenes and I need a minimum of 6 running scenes. Like that's just how it goes.
It's a pretty obvious metaphor for his psyche. Sorry, go ahead.
But anyway, he's a time cop or something. I don't know. He's a pre-crime cop in the new pre-crime future in DC, where this program, it's currently it's only in the DC area, which I think is a fun little like legal side note. But anyway, where 3 precogs who somehow their human rights have been taken away. They never really cover that. It's just like they have no rights. They just are precogs that their job is to sit, float in a saline bath of liquid and predict crime for no money or anything. Like they're just stuck there as slaves. And we kind of skip right past that. You know, like there's not a good explanation in the movie anyway of like, how do we get to this legal future where just enslaving 3 people is fine. Like, I don't know how that happened. But anyway, they predict crime. And for some unknown reason, the process involves fashioning a wooden ball that rolls down a series of tubes. And the explanation in the movie actually is that like, it can't be forged or something. Like it's a quick throwaway line, but I think maybe somebody realized like, hey, we've got all this tech and like these amazing holographic computers and stuff, and yet when they predict something, we whittle a wooden ball. How does that make any sense? So they threw in a line about how like, oh, it can't be forged, which okay, whatever. Well, I guess we'll go with that. And when the little wooden ball comes down and says who the victim and the murderer are, they then get certain access to the images the precogs are seeing in their head. So they're kind of piecing together. They don't know necessarily who or where these people are exactly, so they have to like piece it together from the images in the precog's brain, which I think makes for a really good like thrilling thing. You know, it's a cool crime show conceit, which is we've got to, you know, use these images and see like what where this is and, you know, what time of day it is and with all this stuff, and it's like a cool detective-y thing. So I love the concept. It's super cool. And the other thing that's interesting that I like how they throw in there, which I'm sure is also in the book, or I imagine is in the book, is the fact that like, because of this pre-crime program, the only crimes they ever get now are crimes of passion. So it's always like it's a race against the clock basically, because the crimes of passion are more spontaneous, I guess. So precogs can't see them as far into the future. Whereas we were to assume that when they first instituted the program, you know, they would catch all these premeditated murderers easily, because it's like you have, you know, plenty of time to go through the images and data and find out who it is. But then since people realized like, oh, we live in the pre-crime realm, so the pre-crime era, we'll stop premeditating our crimes. Now it's just crimes of passion, like, for example, the starting sequence And how we get introduced to all this is a man who's going to murder his cheating wife with a pair of scissors. So that's how we start on that. And it's a race against the clock to catch him. And they just barely get him and all that and that kind of thing. And so that's the main concepts here. There's these precogs. They can tell that someone's going to murder. We find out also they can't detect other crime. Like, it's just murder because murder is so bad. But like theft, nah, they can't really see it, I guess.
Yeah, they play really fast and loose with what constitutes a crime that the precogs can see. And like, they do a fine job at adapting it, but I it's sort of, they play with it a little bit there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, well, murder is such a, you know, severe breach of humanity that it's, you know.
And because their system appears to be empathically based, like something that generates that much emotional energy is what triggers their.
But it does seem to suggest that they wouldn't be able to catch psychopaths, or like, if that's a good term, like sociopathic kind of, because like it does seem to suggest, this is kind of a side topic, but it's like it's based on the murder having, didn't it seem like that? Maybe that was just.
I think it's based on the emotional trauma of everyone involved in the experience. They sense the person dying and the person killing.
But I remember them phrasing it like the murderer is doing something so serious to their own psyche that they detect that. So I would be curious if a psychopathic murderer who only kills with a sniper rifle so that the victim never knows what's happening or something like that. You know, like, I feel like they are just fine now.
Right.
They could actually just go on crime spree after crime spree. No one can do anything about it. But that's just my pet theory. So that's, I think, the basics. Anything else that I need to get in there that I didn't?
I don't think so. I mean, we immediately get the antagonist, the initial antagonist of the story. But yeah, I think that's the, it's a really nice setup, I think. It lays out sort of all the tensions very quickly.
All right, episode over, I guess.
No, you have to do something. Plot, you're just doing the sort of act one. I think we should introduce that there are a few other individuals of importance here. We get Colin Farrell as the kind of toolish FBI agent who shows up to snoop around everything.
Yeah, he's investigating. I don't know if. My opening argument's mind went to like, is he an FBI agent? I think he works for the Attorney General of the United States.
Oh yeah, fair enough. He's something or like other. That. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's oversight.
Anyway, he's oversight, Mr. Oversight. And his job is to vet the system because they're considering moving it to a national system. Like right now it's on a trial basis, but the whole, I guess, what makes the plot move largely is that Max von Sydow returning to the show for, I don't know, the 20th time, because he's always in these good movies. He is the director who kind of came up with this whole thing, more or less. And he has vested interest in this program going nationwide. So Colin Farrell's job is to check, like, to make sure this is really all going well before they widen the scale of it. But my question, another question they never answer is, okay, so they're just going to get a billion more precogs in every city to, like, again, where are we getting these precogs?
Yeah.
I don't know how this is happening. It seems like in the movie, at least, it's some sort of, like, drug that they were able to give them, right?
Well, the tie-in is the same, you know, the drug that Tom Cruise is taking, right? The early version of that drug, we find out, is this horrible thing that if you took it, especially while you were pregnant, you'd get crack babies, right? You get really psychologically or mentally deformed children. And this usually happened with, obviously, low-income individuals who would then turn these individuals over to the government, some of whom they discovered had psychic abilities. And so that something,
so it's
the
basically
purge,
Stranger
I don't know.
Things. Yeah, it's Stranger Things before Stranger Things, now that I think about it.
Yeah, and I like the way that the short story short story does it especially, though I want to save talking about that for a little bit. But I do agree that, well, I mean, the whole plot in this movie hinges on this sort of moral question of, is it okay to enslave individuals like that, or specifically to kill their loved ones, right? So a little bit of spoiler, right? This is centered around how they get a hold of those precogs. That is your question. And what we discover is the Max von Sydow character was willing to make trade-offs for the sake of this organization.
That's true. Now that I think about it, because we were talking about it before the show, like there's two concepts we want to talk about. And spoiler, we're doing a follow-up because the short story version is way different. And we want to talk about that in the next episode and talk about more like time travel-y, precog paradoxes and stuff like that. We're going to leave, even though that seems like kind of the obvious topic, we're going to leave that for the next show. But in this one, we're going to talk a little more about utilitarianism. And now that I think about it, you're totally right, because this is literally enslaving three people to save a bunch of lives. Yep. Like, it couldn't be more on the nose for, you know, the typical utilitarian, you know, like problem or whatever.
Yep. And being willing to kill one of their parents for the sake of taking those children. Right. And you're right. Where would more of them come from?
Even in this world was a crime. Like, that's what makes no sense to me. Somehow in this world, the enslaving the precogs isn't a crime. Like, that's okay. But then Max von Sydow, spoilers, we find out that at a certain point, the main precog, the most talented precog, who apparently is the only one that matters, like, the other two don't even do anything. Because once she's stolen, the whole system's broken. They're just like, no, it's useless now. So I don't know
why. Let's be clear. Another
utilitarian question is, why are you still enslaving those two dudes who have no impact on the system of any kind? That certainly is not a good trade-off. But anyway, he was willing to murder the mom of the good precog because she got her stuff together and wanted her daughter back, essentially. But the program was already going, and therefore he had to concoct a plan to murder her in a way that would get around this system. I don't know how that important that is to what we're talking about, but long story short, that was still a crime, but enslaving the precogs wasn't. So that's all I wanted to say. That's a distinction I don't really understand, but okay.
I mean, the way that they hand wave their way through it in the movie, in the culture, is they keep saying the precogs have no consciousness. They're not individuals who should have the freedom to act. Oh, they're completely, they're brain dead. All that they are just receivers for things that are happening. So unfortunately, they then totally violate, or, you know, maybe they don't intentionally violate it, but instead that was all a lie from the start. And you find out that there actually are real people who've been enslaved this whole time.
Oh, that's it. Okay. You're totally right. That's a great point because I guess that would be the whole thing's obviously implausible unless you listen to Serious Inquiries Only. But
yeah,
but like, one plausible way would be to say, you know, if I get in a motorcycle accident tomorrow, even though I don't drive a motorcycle, maybe I'm actually a pedestrian. I get hit by a motorcycle. It's a different kind of motorcycle accident than you thought. And we find out, oh, you know, doctor comes in with his clipboard. He's like, oh, there's no, he's Thomas is not waking up. He's just, he's there, you know. And Aaron's like, cool, do we get to pull the plug? I've always wanted to do that. And then, but then the doctor's like, hold on. Yeah. The doctor's like, hold on. We're just getting somehow this image broadcast from Thomas's brain where he's seeing the future. Like, if that was the ultimate trade-off, which is, well, Thomas is brain dead. He's just going to be sitting in a bed his whole life. But somehow he's able to receive signals from the future. So that I could almost see that if all that were true, like, I could see the ethics of that being okay. Like, being like, well, what's the difference between sitting in a bed, but also sitting in a bed all day, or a tub of goo and then broadcasting futuristic images to us? What's the difference there?
Yeah, I completely agree. It's why I think that it's an interesting question, because when you find out that they're real people, then obviously you have this tension of, would it be okay to put them back in that tank if you knew that you were going to keep the crime rate at zero? That's an interesting utilitarian kind of dilemma. But I do think,
yeah, we'd better start getting to that utilitarian dilemma. Let's get to the philosophy, because we're halfway through already.
I we've talked about that one a little bit before. What I want to drill down here, the reason I wanted to talk about utilitarianism was partly because I want to start getting into objections to major positions that we've talked about before. And I think there is a very common objection that this movie kind of, or this story kind of, flips on its head, which is the idea that utilitarianism is bad because we can't know the future. that often I see get thrown in the face of utilitarians saying, well, how do you know what the consequences are going to be? You can't know what the future is going to be, so you should, you know, never do anything that could possibly be wrong or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Do you ever get that thrown back at you?
Well, yeah, one of the limits of utilitarianism being it's too difficult to know the consequences, essentially.
Right, exactly. And what I like about this movie is that it says, well, even if we did know that, even if we did have perfect knowledge of the future and could prove it, you know, demonstrate it mathematically, you might still, I think, have deontological kind of concerns about, is it really okay to lock up someone who hasn't actually committed a crime yet because you claim to know they were going to commit a crime? Is that a violation of autonomy that yeah. is not okay, even if you can say, but I know with 100% certainty they were going to commit that crime?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think they actually do a pretty good job in the movie of presenting an interesting philosophical argument about this. Yeah. It's a little corny, but what Tom Cruise does, because, you know, Colin Farrell is asking questions about it, like, oh, they didn't actually commit a crime, you know, and then Tom Cruise rolls one of the whittled wooden balls off the table, and Colin Farrell catches it, and he's like, why did you catch that? And he goes, well, it was going to fall. And he's like, but was it ever going to fall if you caught it? You know, that kind of thing. Like, can we say it with certainty, like, this was definitely going to happen, you know, like, and a lot of people, we've talked on opening arguments about this, the difference between attempted murder and murder. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly, it almost seems like a meaningless distinction in some ways, you know, like we've actually gone down that road, I think. And right. I'm trying to remember what Andrew would say, but the idea that, like, if I, you know, if I have you in my sights, and I'm about to pull the trigger on you because you put me in a horrible precog nightmare scape, which I barely escaped from somehow. I don't know how, but we're still furthering the plot of our other movie that we're making up. So I get out. I think Tom Cruise helped me. And I'm like, I need to get revenge on Aaron. First of all, he was going to pull the plug on me. Secondly, he locked me in a tub of goo. So I go to pull the trigger. You're right in my sights. But, you know, like, I miss you by an inch because of the wind or something, you know, like, essentially what I did was exactly the same for me in my, like, everything I was going to do in terms of I planned a murder, I'm carrying it out, I've got you in my sights. That is all identical to the reality in which the wind wasn't as quite as strong or so, whatever variable, you know, like, nothing in me changed, but in one reality, the bullet hits you and you die. In the other reality, you're totally fine. So, like, why are the punishments so different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big old problem with moral luck. The fact that your intent was the same, your action was the same, and yet we treat you differently because of consequences that were far beyond your control. And I find it fascinating that there's a paradox here, and the movie doesn't solve this paradox. The movie cheats its way out of this paradox if you actually pay attention. Like, the ball, I think we can confidently say, right, if you don't catch the ball, it falls on the ground. That's right. A reasonable inductive inference to make. And yet, when you scale that up from something as simple as catching a ball to stopping a murderer, we feel uncomfortable about claiming that it's the exact same kind of thing. And that not some different, that it's just a difference in complexity, not a difference in kind, right? We don't like the fact that we're the ball.
I don't know. How much of an issue do you think this really is? Because, like, is the issue that we're in this movie, they're being punished too harshly? Is that what you're saying?
Well,
attempted murder is still a crime, you know, like, it's not as though in our current world, this wouldn't still be a crime, except, you know what I mean? Like, what is the real issue, do you think?
Well, I think they cheapen the problem by heightening the issue by putting them in that weird, creepy hell place. Like, they shouldn't have done that. They should, you know, put them someplace humane because, look, they haven't committed any crime. Let's put them somewhere where they're just not going to do anything for the period of time that they would have wanted to commit that crime. What I think is a real problem is that this shows the weakness of the objection to utilitarianism about knowing the future, which is, even if we do know the future, our epistemic concerns, I think, don't actually go away, right? Because how do you test if any one of these individuals is actually innocent or guilty? If, unless, you know, setting aside the ones who you catch literally in the act, right? The the one who's, you know, got the thing at the throat, right? Anyone short of that, how can you really claim you're not just putting away an innocent person?
Yeah, that's interesting. What is the difference between that and, you know, the kind of, well, let's kill this person because somewhere down the line, you know, he's going to get behind the wheel and run over somebody. You know, like,
yeah.
Baby, I would definitely kill baby Hitler. Yeah, I don't know. I think that in this world, if we are granting the questions, you know, the hypotheticals that we're in, and we're saying, okay, we do know with a high level of certainty that this was what was going to happen, I think that we probably get around it by punishing it like we punish, you know, if you and I get in a room together and we make a plan to rob a bank and like kill somebody and do, like, that's still a crime, and it can be a pretty serious crime. And I think maybe the way we get around it is we punish that possibly a little more harshly than we would have. You know what I mean? Like, we punish attempted crimes a little more harshly. And therefore, at trial, we're not saying, well, you are guilty of the murder of your wife. And then he's like, but I didn't. You know, we're saying you are guilty of the fact that you were just about to murder your wife. And we punish attempted crime more harshly.
But what do you do in the circumstances where there is no evidence beyond the claims of the precogs that this thing is going to happen? Right. What is the thing that you point to that allows us to say we still know that you were going to, like, if all that's going on is that for months I'm thinking, man, I really want to kill Thomas and take over the head of this job, you know, like the head of this podcast. Like, I want to run this place. Right. But there's no, I didn't ever write it down. I don't tweet it at anybody. Right. Like, I'm just thinking about it real hard. And then they show up and they're like, you've been thinking about this real hard. And all we can do to prove it is this crazy system involving putting people in a vat. Like,
I don't know that this is as interesting a question. Yeah. I don't know that this is as interesting a question as you think. Like, because that just seems to me to be, are we accepting the hypotheticals or not?
Well,
accepting this world where these precogs literally, they only see murders that are about to happen. They don't see, like, I'm thinking about murder, you know, like, we're accepting that scientifically, through the data, and because it was published in a peer-reviewed journal, we know that they could have been on a trial basis for a year where all they did was see murders before they happened, and then we go and recover the body, and it's like, well, they were 100 for 100. You know, like, we could play with the dials to where the question just becomes, how certain do we need to be? You know, like, if we let these precogs just float in a hot tub for a year, and in DC they successfully predict literally every murder for a year, then I think it's very easy to say, no, you were going to murder somebody.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Right,
that
right,
we
right.
You know what I mean?
No, I was going to make a point about how in the way that this world happens, we'd have a hard time eliminating the confounding variable that, like, just because everyone started to believe that this works, the deterrent effect would be enough to prevent anyone from trying to be dumb enough, like they say, to engage in premeditated murder. But you're right. If you can get me a prequel to Minority Report where they just let the precogs watch people just, like, snuff films for, like, a year just to, like, do a double blind study on whether or not
this
works.
I think they would have to do that.
I can watch that. I'm fine. I'm on board.
Yeah, yeah. And then it would be, so, like, I think what confounds it a little bit is how much uncertainty there actually is in the fact that Max von Sydow was kind of fraudulent in what he did. You know, we come to find out that, like, oh no, the precogs don't always agree, and, like, you know, sometimes they have different predictions, and that's what a Minority Report is. And, like, if you got enough of the variables to be that, then I think you would totally have a point. Like, if we run that experiment and we get the APA, you know, on the blower, and we run that experiment, and, you know, they're predicting half of the murders, you know, then it's literally, I don't think you can even do anything with it. Well, I think you can stage interventions, but I don't think you can punish them as though they were going to, because they'll be like, well, the data shows that I was 50-50. You can't, there's no way you can say that I was, statistically, you know, half of the people you've arrested were going to murder people, but, like, you can't say I was going to.
Okay, so good. So let's, you know, the end of the movie, right? The dilemma that Tom Cruise puts to Max von Sydow is saying, you have to either prove that pre-crime works by killing me or not kill me, but thereby prove that the system doesn't get things right 100% of the time. And like you say, if we don't have that 100% accuracy, I don't know. Seems to be 99.9% accuracy. Everyone's going to be like, oh, publish that study and let's all get to call it.
I was going to ask you, like, what threshold do you think would be acceptable? Like, let's take out all the slavery notions and let's hypothetically replace this with the supercomputer that we've developed or something like that. What threshold would you need? You know, does it need to be right 80% of the time?
Like 75, 80, three quarters, 80? I think. I
definitely mean, more than 60%.
I'm a pretty benevolent dictator, I think, if the numbers come out.
But I still think, here's another thing. Actually, you know what? This is probably not on topic, but I just had a revelation. I actually think that this world would turn into a utopia. Hold on, stick with me. Here's the thing. The reason we lock people up most of the time, you know, like the rationale between behind locking people up for as long as we do in the U.S. is, well, safety. And, you know, we got to lock up criminals because they're going to be out on the streets. You know, Willie Horton will be out on the street murdering somebody or whatever. Like, that's always been the scare tactic. Like, we got to put these people away forever because they're just going to. But if you have a system where you're able to predict and intervene in like 100% of murders, you barely need to punish murders because, like, all you have to do is intervene and be like, okay, here's, you know, you were going to do this. You're going to do some community service. And then the danger of them, like, getting back into the, you know, the murdering spree that they were on is minimal because you'll just predict it again and stop it. So, like, I think you actually could stake quite a lot on this and intervene and just not punish people as much as, like, in this world, as you said, they're filing them away in some Black Mirror prison where they just sit. I think it's actually they have good experiences. I think
they have to watch the murder they commit over and over again, isn't it? I don't remember. Shoot, I missed that.
Well, that's more Black Mirror. But in the movie, maybe it's different in the story. But in the movie, the guy, like, when he's putting Tom Cruise away, he's like, "Oh, I think it's supposed to be actually a pretty nice experience when you whatever." But maybe I don't know.
I think they probably have neural activity, but they're trapped.
Okay. Well, anyway, it sort of changes it by, like, this ability to predict and stop murders means you don't have to punish people, like, at all. You know, like, you can just say, hey, slap on the wrist, don't do this, you know, and then if they do it again, then no big deal because you stopped it anyway.
I do think that this movie deliberately sort of cranks up the knob on the human cruelty, fascist-y kind of feel of it because it wants to be a critique of the American justice system having these kind of problems that you're kind of talking about where they just lock people up forever, that, like, this is supposed to be trying to be more humane but still kind of isn't because it still has that weird, you know, punitive but not rehabilitative kind of model to it. And so it still ends up collapsing. But I do think you're right that if you have that different kind of setup, it makes for a different question about what's the big problem here. And that's why
I can't believe we're already kind of out of time, but I want to make sure we didn't give any short shrift to the philosophy question you're talking about. Let's make sure you hit on all that. So this idea, you're trying to say that the objection that utilitarianism doesn't work because you can't know the future, you're saying even if you know, it sounds like you were going to start to say that even if you know the future 100%, there's still problems with utilitarianism that this movie highlights, or what do you think?
What I think is that the intuition, I would be fine with utilitarianism if I could know the future, but since I don't, I'm not as comfortable with the theory, doesn't really hold up if you put someone in a situation where supposedly we know the future. Their anxieties about what it means to punish someone for something they haven't done yet in this sort of situation, I think still kind of exists there. Or there, I think there's a sort of epistemic feeling that you're never going to fully know that you actually are predicting the future and not causing it. So that's another problem that we didn't even get to yet on this one that we can talk some about on the next one, where by making these predictions, we might be altering these people's lives in some kind of way. Especially with the people who have access to those stories.
Yeah, well, geez, we are out of time because we have not quite hit that patron goal to extend the show. And I kind of want to keep going down this vein in the After Dark. I have some hypotheticals I might throw at you that I think are very interesting. So, how did this time fly by so fast? That's really weird. It must have been the precogs. I don't know. They did it. But blame them. So we need to do our normal thing. Who do we got to thank this week?
This week we have to thank, and it's going to be a little bit of a conversation. I just said Picard was the best. You took it to a dark place. And I just want to say, right, anyone who would think that Picard is the best is clearly trapped in a kind of post-colonial patriarchy, given that he is at best the third best. And that's,
I thought you said Picard. I don't know who Picard is, but
Picard.
Picard.
Picard. I need to work on my enunciation. But yeah.
I just wondered if this was some Star Trek spinoff I hadn't watched yet. Yeah, Picard.
Right. From patriarchy to Me Too. That's all I'm saying. It's not that big a jump in my head. So that's why it's not. And I'm always in a dark place. I don't know what to tell you people.
Thank you so much to our top patron for making Aaron say funny things every week. And somebody else definitely can feel free to join top patron. I mean, it's definitely an option people have. So no need to tease next week because we're going to talk more about the time. What is specifically just the issues, the paradoxes, the can you change the future kind of thing.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the short story and how it's a minority report to what we just talked about. And how we can talk differently about the questions of determinism versus indeterminism by comparing the two endings. That's my plan.
Interesting. Okay.
I've already seen it happen.
Well, we'll see you all then. Yeah. And we will see our very fine patrons right now when we do some nice bonus time. See you then.
That's all for the main show. But if you'd like to go to patreon.com/0G, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
The hypothetical is always baby Hitler, you know? But like, when we're talking about this kind of thing, I was thinking, well, what about...
If you're asking me if I can construct a hypothetical where genocide would be morally justified, the answer is I have.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0G. You can find us on Twitter at @0GPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.